Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, mostly on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. So how does cash flow then tie in with sales and stock projections? Because that's obviously the lifeblood, the liquid fuel, as you said, that fuels everything else.
Yeah, of course. So trying to keep it as simplistic as possible, the sales velocity that you're managing to will ultimately deliver a revenue per month into your Amazon account. Obviously, that revenue is then shared between you and the lovely guys at Amazon, and you get the scraps that are left over. Those scraps and deposits that you get once every 2 weeks ultimately feed the beast. That's your cash flow. That's your inflows of cash. Meanwhile, you've got either stock on order or you've got stock on the water waiting to arrive at Amazon, and you've got obviously stock in Amazon. At any one time, you've got assets tied. You've got capital assets tied up, either physically in product or sat in as money in the bank. When we manage, say for instance, if you're trying to sell 500 units per month of something, we're trying to manage that over a 3 or 4 month period, because we're consistently getting our deliveries every 3 months and we're placing our orders every 3 months, like a bit of a daisy chain, to be honest. You place an order and you receive an order at the same time, sort of thing. The situation you kind of get yourself into is you're replenishing at a rate that makes the placing of the order a sure thing, and you can happily be convinced that at that 3 month mark you'll have the cash in the bank to do it. But that only happens if you're selling and turning over that stock as quickly as you're importing it. So there's no point importing in 12 months of one thing and 2 months of another and 1 month of another. You need to know that that's, you know, in my particular situation, obviously you'd have to, there's some complex modeling you need to do to get to these levels of certainties about numbers. But we know that we have to put 3 months of stock into a container, and we need to turn that 3 months of stock around. And that's where the Amazon sales velocity management really comes in. If we leave, so for instance, if we import a 40-foot container that's got our 3 months of stock in it, and by the end of the 3 months, we haven't quite sold all of that stock, that's going to mean that we've got a cash flow bottleneck, because the cash that we were expecting to have back in the business, back setting our bank account ready to purchase the next batch of stock, is actually still locked up as product, sat in an Amazon fulfillment center. So it's about basically churning through that stock in a predictable manner to make sure that you're turning that stock into liquid cash in a predictable and controlled manner. And I'm not saying it's an easy task, and it's a difficult thing to achieve, and there are many levers you need to pull. And I think we'll talk about the levers within Amazon sales velocity management, the ones that we use anyway, in another podcast. But I think just thinking about it in terms of cash locked up versus liquid cash, and what it is you're trying, how quickly it is you're trying to turn your stock around, is a really important thing. And just to ask yourself the question, how many times are you turning your stock this year? Through various reasoning, one of which being the inventory performance index in the States, but mainly because of the cash flow requirement, we have a target of turning our stock 4 times in a year. So like I say, 3 months worth of stock at a time. And we do carry a bit of buffer stock to ensure that we can ward off any issues with slight overperformance on a SKU, but we can't afford to keep too much buffer stock, because again, is it in liquid cash or is it in physical form? And we need to kind of strike that balance.
Yeah, this is such an important question. And I think you've been asked about the fact that it involves some complex modeling. So we will try and sort of reverse engineer some of this. I guess at some point I'm going to have to persuade you to simply, you know, sell your spreadsheet to the more advanced sellers out there. Because I do think honestly, the value of getting this right versus wrong is probably, for somebody doing $1 million a year or something, worth probably at least tens of thousands of dollars. I think it's probably that important, based on the conversations I've had with people who do go out of stock, as you said, and the effects on it. And the more competitive your market is, the more you've got to fight to get your market share, but also to keep your market share, which is one of those things that I think people overlook quite quickly. They feel like launch is so exhausting, it must be done by that point, but no. And in that context, then having predictability becomes more and more critical than ever. And obviously, cash flow projections, so business life critical, isn't it? It's basically like monitoring blood pumping around the system. And if the heart runs out of blood to pump, that's when you end up hospitalized very swiftly as a person. And as a business runs out of cash, that is when bankruptcy beckons, right? So it's obviously critical, but having a sophisticated model for doing it, I think is so important. So we will dig into detail about that. So if you're curious about it and go, but what about the detail? We'll get there. But it's always interesting also to see what people peg as their stock desirable amount. I know there's some people that the upper limit's probably marked by a couple of people we know in the masterminds who probably want up to 12 months worth of stock, which is kind of the opposite extreme. And you're kind of more typical. Tell us a little bit about the inventory performance index for those who haven't come across it, who's not had the luck to not come out of it yet. What is that? And why is that important? How does that affect the discussion?
Yeah, so it's a score that Amazon have introduced in the United States. When I say introduced, it was about 12 months ago now. And essentially, it's a way of them trying to make sure that sellers manage their inventory in a way that keeps stock flowing. End of the day, Amazon don't want to just warehouse lots of stuff in their warehouses and their fulfillment centers, sorry. They want to see stock turning around. So they have particularly one metric within the inventory performance index, which turns out to be one of the more important metrics, especially when you are storing serious volume of product, which is the sell-through rate. And the sell-through rate basically takes your, the way to think about it is, if you have 3 months worth of stock at the beginning of the 3 months, and at the end of the 3 months, you have no stock. So you've managed to turn around all of your stock in 3 months. You would have a sell-through rate of 1. That's, on their scale, actually poor to really poor. In my mind, if you turn around your stock 4 times in a year, you're doing pretty well from the logistics perspective, especially when it takes 90 days from order placement to getting something into Amazon. And that's if you've got your kind of logistics and stuff really nailed. So yeah, the IPI is a way of keeping people in line. The issue can occur if you're, for instance, if your sell-through rate really drops to 0.0 something. And like I say, in combination with storing quite a volume of product, as we are and as we do, that basically can impose limitations on the amount of stock that you're allowed to keep at Amazon. The magic number is 350 on the IPI inventory performance index. And if you drop below that, you get a nasty email that comes through to say, hey, you're going to get limited. And anything over that limitation is going to be charged at a rate of probably 10 times. I think it was 10 times the amount that you should be paid. So yeah, it's a pretty important thing. It could cost you a lot of cash if you get it wrong. And we actually do as you would imagine, we have a forward forecast of what our IPI will be over every month. And that allows us to understand what we need to keep at Amazon in storage, but also what we need to keep externally to Amazon in an external storage facility. And we manage our IPI, basically. And that's IPI. If you want to go and have a look at it, best to Google a few things on it, and then you'll soon see it. If you haven't suffered it yet and you're selling in the UK, apparently they are introducing it into the UK in the short term. So you'll soon become well acquainted.
Yes, I remember you going through this in great detail. It must have been in Barcelona. We had a meeting in Barcelona, which happens once a year. So that would be what, June, July?
June, July.
Yeah, well, I remember we dug into this in huge detail because there was a great panic. And I think it's one of those, was it a 90-day trailing metric or something like that?
We
concluded. So yeah, it's one of those things that won't immediately change overnight, like a lot of critical things. So just the sell-through rate, which is obviously one of those important metrics. The sell-through rate of 1 means what again? That you're selling... you're selling all your product in 12 months or something. Is that right?
The sell-through rate is the way to think about it is it's a ratio of how much you're selling and how much stock you've got.
Yeah.
So the way that, I just simplify it down almost, if you put 3 months worth of stock in to Amazon on day one, and you sold through all of that stock within those 3 months, you would have a sell-through rate of one. If, however, you sold through that same amount of stock that you put in day one in 6 months, you would actually have a sell-through rate of 0.5, because you've actually you actually had 6 months worth of stock in there. So 3 months worth of stock in Amazon is essentially a sell-through rate of one.
Okay, so that's basically what they want. They're just pushing us to, this is stuff that's stored in the FBA warehouses or the fulfillment centers. Okay, so basically that implies that if you're going to keep any much more stock than that, apart from maybe a bit of safety stock, you better be looking for third-party warehouses.
Yeah, one is kind of their lowest acceptable performance. So if you start to drop below one, from experience, that's where we start to have problems. Like I say, there's a bit of a complexity around that mechanism, because Amazon aren't very clear on exactly how they calculate IPI, despite
this is Amazon, right? They're not clear about how they calculate anything, really. I mean, they never reveal. I'm sure they're super clear about how they calculate it, they just don't communicate it. Talking about communicating, but yeah, you're right, we have to guess. But that's a good rule of thumb. I mean, for anyone who's got the appetite you have for the maths and the modeling, then they can try and model it. But a rule of thumb of sell through once every 3 months, or you're going to get into trouble in America, and probably coming to an Amazon warehouse near you if you're selling in the UK, or for that matter the rest of Europe, it's a good rule of thumb. And if nothing else, if you're getting close to that, then it warrants further investigation. If you're miles away from it, probably not worth fussing, right? Talking of 80-20. Okay, so look, we've dealt with some pretty serious micromanagement, but you know, detailed projection that you've dealt with. Let's zoom right back out now. And we've talked about a hell of a lot of different stuff. One thing we haven't mentioned is, you mentioned team briefly. Let's talk about that. So obviously you said that you sort of quickly said something like you need to expand your team sometimes before you actually need them. So I guess that ties in with the cash flow question, doesn't it? At what point in your philosophy of business, which I think is a bit different from some people's, do you start expanding the team? How do you justify that expense? Let's start with those two questions.
Good questions. So the obvious answer would be to say, oh, well, when you start running out of capacity. But to be perfectly honest, I don't feel like I've had an overt amount of capacity spare anyway. And it is all down to prioritization, essentially. But yeah, so we last year had a look at where we were going in terms of kind of linking back to the projections and what our budgets were going to look like and what we could afford to do. And as a result, I took a view that actually we could afford to take on some people. That would make life easier. It'd also allow us to start doing things that we had deprioritized or taken off the table because we simply don't have enough time, or not done enough research about and didn't really understand enough. And that kind of freedom was provided by the fact that we had some visibility of what our next 12 months was going to look like. So this isn't something we just kind of one day woke up and decided, hey, I've run out of capacity, we need to go and hire somebody. It was something of, well, can we afford to take these people on? At what point can we afford to take them on? We've got a plethora of things we know we can get them to work on, but what sort of skill sets does that actually demand that we put in place? As it happens, we did something actually slightly weird in that we took a look at what we were doing inside the business. And it's worth saying, give you a bit of an idea of what the team structure looked like back sort of November, December last year. And actually, it's worth saying also at this point that November last year, my firstborn child, little Rosalie, was born on November 21st. So, things got quite busy towards the end of last year. The team consisted of myself, and I managed pretty much everything within the Amazon account and those types of anything Amazon related, really. I had my marketing assistant, Ola, and she's a UK-based assistant who works alongside me. And she was managing basically everything off of Amazon. So websites, social media. She was utilizing a virtual assistant to help with social media at one point, but that again came out in the wash with a team restructure. That we basically kind of looked at each other and said, well, what do we aspire to do? Not just from a kind of the Amazon perspective, but the bigger the bigger picture. What can we afford within the budget based on what it is we want to achieve? So as a result, instead of looking to the task list and saying, well, I can hire this person to take this thing off me from an Amazon perspective, I actually took the executive decision, rightly or wrongly, to keep hold of a lot of the Amazon stuff and keep myself very involved in everything Amazon. And the team that we expanded out was a team that was designed to expand our social media, expand our website and organic traffic, namely our organic traffic through the website and through to Amazon. And this was something that was discussed with Sadie, my project manager, and she's an expert at hiring people. Yeah, she basically helped us draft some role outlines and figure out what it is we needed to do, and got us hiring people in the Philippines. And approach has been very much to hire team members, not virtual assistants. So there's another driving principle for you when it comes to team hiring and team building. We're certainly not hiring virtual assistants. It's a case of we need to bring people on that we're looking to employ forever. We openly say that we, within our adverts, that we hire for keeps. That's our kind of tagline, if you like. So we're trying to attract the right kind of people, and so far so good. But yeah, that in terms of the original question around how do you know when and how do you go about doing that sort of thing, it comes down to for me, understanding your budget and understanding your aspirations. And those two things need to be quite clear before you can go hell for leather into doing these things. I think it's quite easy to fall into the trap of thinking, particularly with the kind of conventional wisdom that's out there about you need to SOP everything and then you can just hand it off to somebody who can go and complete it like a robot. That's not the way to go about these things. And I think, unfortunately, the conventional way of thinking about, oh, well, I've run out of capacity, I need somebody to take these tasks off me and just complete those tasks, get it off my plate. Yeah, okay, it can work for a short time. And I'm sure there are lots of people who are having success out there with very capable virtual assistants doing that, taking that sort of approach. But I much prefer the approach that we're taking.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, I think there's a lot to think about here. I mean, one of the things which strikes me is that on the one hand, you were talking about financial constraints in terms of new SKUs, but I've noticed over the last that's 12 months, I guess, since we last spoke on the podcast, I'm noticing in the meetings and following your journey that you're very keen to, you find it quite easy to justify to yourself spending some money on hiring team members. So can we ask a couple of rude questions? What sort of money it costs to, well, first of all, what is your current team now then? And what sort of money are we looking at, just to get some ideas? You don't have to reveal anyone's individual salaries, obviously, if they're listening. But
Yeah, the team now, we've got a team. Sadie, project manager, is still there. Ola is still here. The actual original intention was that we would be hiring a replacement for Ola, because Ola was with me working, for minimum wage, essentially, in the UK. And that was all to gain experience. But she decided to stay, which was brilliant. It caused, again, you know, wasn't in the predictions or the cash flow forecast, but something we managed to adapt and work around. And Sadie and Ola are still there. And we've actually taken on three Filipino ladies, Katrina, Kat, and MJ. And they're essentially employed in the digital marketer role, and there's lots of stuff within their role outlines that's quite broad based and gives them a lots of creative freedom to investigate and research new methodologies that we should be using, and basically learn from the best in the industry, and pull all that research and data led stuff that you'll go and find easily on Google, and actually give them the opportunity to put together a plan and implement that for the business and for the brand. And yeah, that's the team. In terms of sort of the costs of a team, you know, the obvious question straight away would be, well, why the Philippines? And part of that is because hiring somebody in the UK is a quite an expensive endeavor for a small business. It's an endeavor you can't take on lightly. Not to say that it's any less of an endeavor that you should take lightly in the Philippines at all. And like I say, if there was any risk that we couldn't pay our team members on a monthly basis, I would be absolutely distraught. And that's not a risk I'm willing to take. You know, these are people that we're bringing into the team as family members. And like I say, these people, hopefully these guys will be working with me for the rest of their working lives. And that's my aspiration. But yeah, we, in terms of hiring in the Philippines, we had job ads out that were basically ranging between 400 and $800 per month. And if you kind of go and have a search around for kind of typical salaries and things like that, you'll see that sort of spread, particularly if you go to, say, onlinejobs.ph, that's sort of the advised levels. And that's what's come to fruition. We've got some very committed and capable people within that salary range. And that's a real success. And it's something that's allowed us to grow.
So the Philippines, interesting that you're saying you take hiring people in the Philippines seriously. And I think that's a responsible approach. And also it's one of those two-way things, isn't it? Talking about the public vitriism and that Stephen Covey principles, if you're looking for win-win, if you communicate the fact to somebody that you take their livelihood as seriously as you want them to take your business, guess what? You're more likely to have commitment from them to your business because you're showing commitment from you to them and their salary, right? And their future. The exactly. Salary range, just to check, $400, $800 a month. Is that for full-time equivalent or what sort of number of hours?
Yeah, no, full-time equivalent.
That's for serious people with some good training and experience, is it?
Yeah. So yeah, and like I say, you can get a whole range. We were actually quite keen on sort of a specific profile of people who had some work experience, and we were quite open to the idea of having somebody who wasn't as experienced. We're quite happy to actually do quite a lot of the coaching. And the reason for that is because if you're the one that is helping to create the habits, you can at least have some sort of say in whether they're good or bad habits. And in some cases, obviously, you can, in particular, if you take the approach that you're just hiring somebody to solve a problem and you don't want to get involved with helping them kind of learn and progress, you can get yourself into a situation where you're handing off to somebody who's not as capable as you would wish and hope, or potentially even doing something negative and impacting to your business. So it's definitely something to be conscious of. And like you say, we were hiring degree qualified people, essentially. That was one of the stipulations, although we were open to the idea of just experience based as well.
Okay, so degree qualified people for $400 to $800 a month. I mean, it's, I have to say that I have some personal experience of using VAs. I haven't used huge numbers, but I've got a podcast editor in the States. I've got a website guy in Serbia who was in Norway last time I spoke to him. A designer in Poland, and I've used VAs in the Philippines. And I have to say, there's some good people everywhere, but there is some consistently great quality in the Philippines. It always just amazes me how little it costs. So. I think it's one of those things that is more of a barrier in people's minds than it is in reality. Because if you think about the cost of investing in a new product line, if it's private labeled and you've got to develop it, you're measuring it in tens of thousands a year, aren't you, probably? So that's quite interesting to put it in perspective. So team building has obviously been a critical thing for you. By the way, yes, Ola. So the famous Ola, who I've heard about, and you mentioned her last year. So you started off as your assistant. She stayed on. So what is Ola's role now then, would you say? Is she still your kind of executive assistant? And is that a useful thing to have? Or is that developed?
So yeah, so Ola's position has actually developed because throughout last year, as you said, we were making investments in discovery, basically. We weren't investing in too many Amazon hacks or trying to understand what the next Amazon tactic was. We were actually very focused on how we created more levers for Amazon sales velocity management. Again, we'll come back to what those levers are in another episode, but essentially Ola built up a lot of capability specifically around influencer marketing, but not necessarily for the typical reasons you might expect behind influence marketing. We weren't actually as interested in their influence as what we were interested in the various levels of value that they could provide. These people, you know, do fantastic imagery that you'd pay many tens of pounds per image for from a photographer. And in those cases, you wouldn't have the authenticity and the actual live interaction and ownership by the influencer or the blogger. Equally, we look at value in things like the blog and backlinks and all sorts of other SEO stuff that related back again to our drive towards more organic growth. So Ola's capabilities kind of moved in this direction of brand and collaboration management. So we thought, well, if it's gone in that direction, let's call you that. She's the brand and collaborator manager within the business. And she's got a strategic viewpoint over what it is that we're trying to achieve. She understands the fact that we have a working principle when it comes to influencers and anything we do really in the business, where we're trying to squeeze out as many forms of value from what it is we're doing. So for instance, when working with influencers, it's about building a long-term relationship where we can extract more and more value out over time as we expand product lines, and we can work with them on whether it be giveaways, new reviews, etc., new reviews on their blogs, that is, and things like that. So yeah, she's really, actually we had a meeting this morning, and I actually actively said to her after the meeting that I was extremely proud of the work that she'd done. And yeah, no, I am seriously proud of where she's come from and where the level she's delivering at now. It's something that I'd be extremely upset to have lost the opportunity to have continued working with her, and the fact that I'd get to continue working, I'd feel very lucky about.
Excellent. Well, that sounds like it's obviously very positive. I mean, you are generally very, very positive and enthusiastic person, which I'm sure, as I was saying to your project manager, who I'm considering doing a bit of work with now, as well, as you know, but before you came on that call, just so if your ears were burning, and that thing that's obviously very important, but that's a very general thing. But what I think is great is that you have clear strategic objectives, and we'll talk about strategy a bit more in a minute, because that's the sexy word for me. It's not hacks. It's not the latest Amazon algorithm. The word algorithm is less sexy to me than strategy, because that's sustainable long-term and also under our control, right? But what I think is amazing is that you've got the clarity of strategy, you've got you're developing things organically, but you really, really value the people. I think you put your money where your mouth is, literally. I mean, in your situation, say about this time of last year, a lot of people would have been spending whatever surplus cash they had on new product lines. And I'm not saying that's wrong either. There's lots of ways to grow this business, as we've seen, which is always what fascinates me. But what's so interesting about you is that you've really put a great value on your team. And as a result, you've got a loyalty from somebody who looked like they could very easily have headed off somewhere else for a lot more money, but they didn't. And they've become a great asset to your business in the sort of medium and hopefully long term. So not something that's going to work for everybody if they're not really team oriented, but certainly something that if you are that way inclined, it's going to be an interesting inspiration, hopefully, for what's possible with a team. So have you got any other thoughts on team to wrap that sort of team bit up?
Yeah, so I've had the luxury of working in the same, very same office, very same room as Ola in the time that I've worked with her. She's now actually working remotely because she's actually down in London while I've stayed in Northampton. But we always knew that was actually probably going to end up being the case. But I was also very conscious, therefore, of ensuring that if we were going to bring new team members into the fold, we were going to have a mechanism and a methodology behind our communication and our interaction that couldn't necessarily entirely replace the ability of sitting next to somebody, because, you know, there's all those fantastic informal conversations and things that you can learn just by being sat next to somebody. But actually, how, you know, the challenge was, how do you create that ability to work like that, but in a virtual environment? And we very simply put our heads together and thought, well, actually, how about we build our very own team site? And as a result, before we even went out to hire anyone, we put a team site together that has a forum inside it. And within that forum, we get to do active brainstorming, just like we would if we were sitting across the desk from each other. And then we have best practices shared, not just SOPs, but literally, hey, here's a great piece of training from Ezra Firestone. Go and do this piece of training if you're looking for this. And it's all nicely categorized and all these other types of things. So the other key aspect of it is that actually when you log into the site, you get taken to a page that reinforces what it is that our company is all about, what it is that we aspire to be. And any person in the business can very quickly flick through the videos or the slideshows that are on the homepage to reinforce or reiterate what it is the goals of the business are for the next 12 months, without me being sat there next to them and explaining it. They've got access to all that information. So actually, I feel like my team now are more informed than Ola ever was, even despite the fact that she sat next to me for so long. So yeah, the key bit for me there, and that if I was to kind of sum that up, is that, you know, preparation behind and planning behind that type of thing is fantastic. But that ongoing maintenance of kind of the principles of what it is you're doing as a business, reinforcing the things that you think are principles. You know, we kind of really go on about learning being at the core of our business, and you should be learning something new every day, every week, and you should be sharing that information. These are all great things to say, but how do you then demonstrate that principle? And, you know, we kind of thought, well, hey, you know, the team site demonstrates that principle actively, and I'm an active member of the forum. I'm constantly sharing information, and the team so far, I think, really like it. So yeah, and it's a different way of working for them. They've certainly not had anything like that in the past.
Yeah, and as a recent sort of guinea pig for using your team site outside of the e-commerce space in using it for the podcast, I have to say that the other day I was doing some research, for example, because I've obviously launched in the 10K Collective podcast, and I was looking at podcast SEO and launch strategies, very similar to launching an Amazon product. And I gathered it all together. My instinct was to gather it together on the team site. Why? Because even though it's just me at the moment and I'm beginning to bring people on, I'm going to do rapidly, it's good to have things that aren't just split between the usual places, right? A Skype chat here, an email there, and God, email's a terrible place to keep information, because as soon as you open your emails up to find information, you start responding reactively to a bunch of emails from somebody else, right? I mean, worst case scenario is it's some kind of product negative review, because that completely throws you off course because it feels like an emergency. And you know, but having it in one place that is your structure, not just Google Drives, although Google Drives are a fantastic resource, and I'm trying to focus everything there. But I do think it's helpful. And what I really like as well is to, and not just in terms of the sort of thinking of things as communication tools or structure, but the entire mentality behind it is that you need to sell to external parties, like obviously your customers who are paying you, but you also need to sell to people who you're paying. That includes your Chinese suppliers. You've mentioned that they need to be sold on the idea that you're going to be placing lots of future orders, so it's worth them investing in things that will smooth the supply chain out. But you're also selling, if you like, the idea of working for your business and why it's a cool place to work and why it continues to be an even better place to work, and building that loyalty by effectively putting an internal focus on selling internally, if you like, to your staff. And big corporations end up doing that, I guess, because they're fighting against the fact that it's probably not a cool place to work because it's faceless and soulless, and they have an HR department, so they've got to do something. But what I think is pretty unique in your approach is that you're doing all of that hard work right up front, instead of when you get so big and sprawling that everyone kind of hates it and wants to leave. So I think it's an incredibly positive thing. And again, in the Amazon space, I think pretty unusual. I don't know many other people who have such a conscious team building sort of emphasis on making it a great place to be and clarity of communication across the piece. So I really think it's an example. And I hope that other people will follow your example with the team site thing, because I'm personally beginning to find it really helpful. And we'll see how that develops over time. But it's obviously a win for you and your team.
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, coming back to if you've got a goal or an aspiration, that's what will fuel the ideas and the innovation. So our aspiration, when we decided to go and embark on this idea of let's grow the team, let's hire some more people, was we want to be an employer of choice, and we want to be somebody who people actively seek out to want to be employed by. And that's a massive aspiration for a tiny business that operates out of a back bedroom in Northampton. I accept that. But hey, you know, there's nothing wrong with audacious big aims like that, because it sets a mindset. You know, when you're hiring people, then you're not just seeing them as a resource that you can utilize to just get a task done. You're seeing them as an extension of you. And if you can get them to operate within the operating principles that you're trying to reinforce. And, you know, these aren't things that you're just going to see in bullet points on a PowerPoint presentation. These are things you have to actually live and demonstrate. Then that's the type of aspiration you need to start with. Otherwise, it'll just wane and you just won't have the energy to keep it up.
And again, that's the classic corporate thing, isn't it? It's not just things on a PowerPoint. I mean, there are so many books that talk about writing a mission statement either for yourself or for the business. And I think it's particularly American books. And of course, they've got a written constitution that they revere. They're always saying, I'll take the fifth on that. And what their amendments, never mind the actual constitution, are quoted all the time in everyday life. And we don't even have a written constitution in the UK. I mean, we kind of do. It's a messy business. I'm not going to get into constitutional law. But the point being, we tend to set less store by that. And anyone who's worked in a corporate, there's a good reason why. And the reason is because basically we don't trust it. We think it's just hot air and it's just a PowerPoint presentation. So what you're going to do is go into a boardroom, say, oh, we do this, because it sounds good and the shareholders like it. And then, of course, what that means is in practice that everyone just ignores it. So thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.